Good afternoon, friends and comrades, to the latest of our Sunday afternoon meeting. Today's talk is entitled The Real 19th Century Prophet Was Dostoevsky, Not Marx, Why Socialists Should Read Dostoevsky. We've got a guest speaker who some of you may doubtless already know, Dave Flynn. Dave estimates you're going to speak for about 45 minutes roughly.
Yeah.
Then we'll
hopefully.
Directly after that, as is usual. I'm going to hand you straight over to Dave.
Thank you, Rob. And thank you for everyone for coming. Really appreciate it. For those of you who don't know, I used to be a member of the party. Left in 2002, worked under the Socialist Standard with Adam and Dave Perrin, been on the EC. So it's nice to come back again. Last time I was here was when you were talking, Rob, 7 months ago. So thanks for everyone for turning out. Dostoevsky. Okay, first of all, I want to say the title, as Rob read it out, was slightly unnecessarily provocative. I'm not certainly advocating that Dostoevsky was the prophet of the 20th century. Albert Camus said that he was. He was the one who made the statement, Dostoevsky will be the prophet of the 20th century, not Marx. That was just put there as a sort of an advertising thing. I don't intend to talk about Camus' work on Dostoevsky at all, actually. Just thought that was a provocative title which sets the mood. And that's pretty much all I'm going to say about that. But I do believe socialists should read Dostoevsky. So, also another thing, this is a work in progress. So my ideas are still forming. I'm by no means satisfied. I'm not by no means satisfied with what I'm about to say. Every day it changes. So you catch me in full flow. And and I don't speak any Russian. I won't be... If I scrambled any language, please forgive me. And I hope, Steve, you've got that book to sharp at the right moment. Thank you. I've got my Dave on the keyboard over here. Fantastic. Okay, so the first thing to point out is that there should never be a good reason for not reading the works of anyone considered worth reading. Ignorance for its own sake is never a good thing. Dostoevsky is not only one of the most influential Russian writers, along with the likes of Pushkin, Tolstoy and Chekhov, he transcended the novel form, arguably like no other. In the light of Camus' statement, it should be imperative for socialists to be familiar with this extraordinary writer. I intend not only to provoke and stimulate, but also to genuinely whet your appetites for what could be a fantastic intellectual and spiritual journey. And more on the spirit later. So what was Camus referring to? And like I say, I'm only going to mention it in passing, really. In a nutshell, Dostoevsky could see where the revolutionary project was headed with his penetrating psychological study of the radical, rational, nihilistic mindset modelled in novels such as Crime and Punishment and The Possessed. Thank you. You might have to get it up again in a minute, Steve. Sorry, I might have been premature. From this, he was able to foresee the nightmarish implications of the Russian Revolution at least half a century before it happened. The implication, of course, was that ultimately Marx, or moreover, the revolutionary project itself, was inherently flawed. But Dostoevsky was not just a dusty old reactionary naysayer. As we will see, he had a utopian project of his own. In this talk, I will give a broad overview as to Dostoevsky's place in literature, politics, and history, and how it is possible not only to learn deep lessons from a genuine critic, but also to find common ground. I will outline aspects of his so-called native soil conservatism and discuss its relationship to that of the radicals of his day. This will include a discussion about the native soil's ascetic theory, which I juxtapose with what I call the Socialist Party's instrumentalist utilitarian propaganda model. So I'm going to be saying a little bit about how the case for socialism is put. And I say that, as I say, not in a hostile way. I'm still very, very, very empathetic to the party, and I would have voted for you on last Thursday had you had candidates in London. In fact, I went there expecting to vote for Danny and found out he wasn't on my ballot paper. I was very disappointed. So that's the spirit in which I come today. I will conclude with a short analysis of his famous novel, Crime and Punishment, where I hope some of his political, philosophical ideas will crystallise in artistic form. And we'll be seeing a little clip from that later on. By the way, this is Dostoevsky, in case you haven't wondered. What we will see is Dostoevsky's critique of reason, or rationalism, and aspects of his own transcendental utopianism. That's my phrase. I kind of invented that. Quite happy with it. Thank you. By the end of the talk, I will hope it will be apparent as to why socialists should read Dostoevsky. Okay. A slight digression before I start properly. In late 1994, well, I was actually a member of the SPGB, the great philosopher of science, Karl Popper, died. I read an obituary of one of the broadsheet newspapers, which said he was Marx's, when he was alive, Marx's greatest living critic. I was vaguely familiar with him, but I knew next to nothing about him. My instinct was to get some material on him or by him, for I could not rest with a knowledge gap. So this guy dies, he's Marx's biggest critic, I don't know much about him, I need to find out. That's what I'm talking about. What if someone was to bring him up in an argument? The upshot was I discovered that it was possible to be both a socialist as well as being a Popperian. In fact, there were other members of the SPGB at the time who also declared themselves to be Popperians. So is it possible to be a socialist, a Marxist, and a Dostoevskian? Das ist die Frage, as they say in German. Is it possible to hold at least two contradictory or seemingly contradictory positions simultaneously? I will return to this later and posit, is it possible to be both a socialist and a Dostoevskian? I'm going to say yes, but I intend to have a little bit of fun trying to show you how that's possible, because it is counterintuitive, no question about that. Indeed, when we were organising this talk, Steve Clayton, Comrade Clayton, over there, wrote me a very enthusiastic email asking me if I was going to be talking about The Possessed. Thank you. The novel most associated with Albert Camus' Dostoevsky fixation, about the criminal activities, including murder and rape, of a group of Russian nihilists in the 1870s, based upon a true story, the Nechev affair. I replied, probably to Steve's surprise, that I was not, which may have come as a surprise to Steve. One reason being practical, it's a very long, complex novel, and I've only read it once. And the other, I wish to challenge what I deem to be the instrumentalist utilitarian attitude that I think the Socialist Party has towards literature, certainly had it when I was in the party, by not concentrating deliberately on Dostoevsky's most political of novels. What do I mean by this? Well, it'll become apparent as we go through the talk. So, what I'm saying is, I want you to hold this idea in your head. I'm saying the Socialist Party's model for propaganda is very utilitarian, very instrumentalist. It is designed to achieve a certain purpose. You read an article, you rationally convince someone becoming a socialist. I'm gonna link that to Dostoevsky's artistic theory and see if we can talk about that. So yeah, slightly provocative, but I don't mean it in a bad way. Until a few years ago, I pretty much eschewed literature as an area of knowledge worth investigating. This, I believe, was a philistine attitude, and I do believe it was reinforced by my experiences in the party. Although members did read literature privately, the only literature that was ever really pushed or talked about was socialist stuff, like The Ragged Trousers of Philanthropists, The Jungle, News from Nowhere, that kind of thing. When it came to human nature questions, personally, I preferred, as did most people in the party, evolutionary biology, anthropology, that kind of stuff. I couldn't see how literature could help with human nature because it wasn't scientific. But I believe now I was wrong. I was once in a bookshop with a former member of the SPGB, Comrade Watkins, and I saw Crime and Punishment on the shelf, and I knew he read literature I knew he read literature. And I said, is that any good? And he said, yeah, it's quite good. So a few months later, I remembered he said it was quite good, and I bought it and I read it. But I didn't really understand it. And the reason I didn't understand it was because I didn't have a frame of reference. Now, a frame of reference is, as everyone will appreciate, so important when you're reading novels, particularly Russian novels. If one is not vaguely aware of Russian culture or society of the period in which you're reading, you'll only have a limited appreciation. Whilst having a reasonable knowledge of pre-revolutionary Russia, up to 1917 and all that jazz, I really didn't know anything about what was happening in the literary world in the 1840s and the 1880s. I did not fully appreciate that due to censorship, the Russian intelligentsia discussed ideas, polemics, and philosophy through the medium of literature, perhaps more than any other society. So there's an argument, which I think is correct, that Russia was a peculiar case when it came to literature. Its literature is of a different stripe to possibly any other society, which is why it's the most interesting form of literature as far as I'm concerned. So that was the context in which I first read Crime and Punishment. So, okay. So, who was Fyodor Dostoevsky? I'm going to give you a brief overview now. There he is. Nice beard, like Rob's and mine. Probably would get into trouble at airports these days, but...
Oh, he's gone.
Bring him back. Unlike many other Russian writers of his time, Dostoevsky was not of aristocratic stock. He was born in 1821 and his father was an army doctor that eventually managed to buy a title, a gentry title, complete with some serfs. At his father's insistence, he reluctantly attended engineering college, but his real passion was literature. His first novel, Poor Folk, which is on your list, was published in 1846 to critical acclaim. Russia's leading critic of the time, a man called Varisan Belinsky, proclaimed a new Gogol. Gogol was, for those of you who don't know, was after Pushkin, probably the biggest writer in the early part of the Russian 19th century. So Belinsky, the top critic of the day, reads this small novel by an engineering student, or someone who's just graduated from engineering college, and says, and apparently he found where Dostoevsky lived, went into his flat in the middle of the night, woke him up, kissed him Russian style on the cheeks three times and said, "Sir, you are the new Gogol." That's apparently what happened. However, when his next novel came out, The Double, which is also on your list, and if it isn't on your list, ask a friend. I only bought 20 copies. I didn't want to be presumptuous. But it failed to impress Belinsky, and Belinsky effectively dropped him. This hit Dostoevsky very, very hard. It looked like he may be a one-hit wonder. And it was around these times that he became influenced by the liberal utopian socialists. That was a popular current amongst the Russian intelligentsia at the time, and he started attending meetings. He went to the meetings of the Pretoshevsky Circle, and he got arrested, and he got into all sorts of trouble, and he was sentenced to 4 years in jail and an indefinite term in the Siberian Army. So this is, he's about 29 years old, I think, at this stage. So he goes to a reading group, participates with a group of utopian socialists who weren't violent and were peaceable and propagandistic. Might sound a little bit familiar. And it was a big, big crackdown. He returned to European Russia 10 years later. It was during this time that Dostoevsky went from left to right. So his prison experience is pivotal. He goes into prison as a utopian socialist, comes out as a supporter of the Tsar. Sounds a bit weird. And during this process, he rediscovers his Eastern Orthodox Christianity. This change in opinion was reflected in his major post-Siberian works, including The House of the Dead, Notes from Underground, Crime and Punishment, The Idiot, and The Brothers Karamazov, which was completed a few months before his death in 1881. You can see all those on your list. Okay, I mean, just a little comparison with Marx now. They were contemporaries, but not a lot of crossover, I don't believe. I'm not even sure they even were how aware they were of each other. Reputations aside, Dostoevsky and Marx, ostensibly at least, share a lot in common. They both lived during the same period. Marx was 3 years older. That outlived Dostoevsky by 2 years. Both were terrible with money, as we all know. Dostoevsky was a notorious gambler and often lived a hand-to-mouth existence, same as Marx. Both were involved with journalism. Dostoevsky was particularly involved with journalism during his later years in the 1870s, and it's all been put into one book called Diary of a Writer, which is again on your list. And it was in this journal that where it's a collection of his essays and short bits of fiction where he's often battling with the radicals of the day. All of this is going through the periodicals and through the magazines, these polemics going backwards and forwards. Both were influenced by Romanticism and, of course, Utopian Socialism. And in both writers, it's possible to delineate an early period, a mature period. Obviously, we know about the Marx one. You know, you had the early 1840s, and then you had the development of historical materialism, Capital in the 1860s, and so on and so forth. And with Dostoevsky, I've split it up into pre-Siberia, post-Siberia. It's the easiest way to do it. Follows almost exactly the same timeline as Marx, actually. But I would argue maybe you can see a bigger gap or shift in Dostoevsky's development than you can in Marx. It's quite obvious that if someone goes from left to right, you can find, it's easier to plot the difference. Okay, yeah. And of course, when he comes out of prison, he's left radicalism behind. He's become a form of Russian Slavophile. And but as I will say, this I don't believe this puts Dostoevsky beyond the pale. So Slavophilism, you know, the belief that the solution to the world's problems lie with the Slavs, particularly Russian Slavophilism. It was a very conservative ideology, hated Western development in many respects, and Dostoevsky was involved or became involved in that. Okay. Let's have a little bit of context. The 19th century Russia. Okay, that's the context of what we're talking about here. So first of all, you've got Peter the Great in the 17th and 18th century creates a series of reforms which is designed to take Russia or orientate Russia westwards. He builds St. Petersburg, an artificially constructed city in the marshland by the Baltic coast for this very purpose, to signify the new Russia, away from her Slavic roots. From here, you've got the two great cities, Petersburg and Moscow, personifying the split personality of the enigma that will become Russia. Moscow, the seat of the traditionalist elite. Petersburg, the embodiment of the new modernist elite. This duality would be played out in literature and politics of the 19th century, particularly with the case of Dostoevsky. Indeed, we shall see that the West versus the Slavophiles, or which direction for Russia, can still be seen today with the current crisis in the Crimea and the Ukraine. However, it is impossible to understand 19th century Russian literature at all, let alone Dostoevsky, without first understanding this, what I've just said. 1812 was the year that saw Napoleon's defeat in Russia, which led to many members of the officer class experiencing Europe and France in particular at first hand, becoming infused with progressive European ideas and bringing them back to Russia. However, the post-war situation gave way to a period of reaction, and you had the death of Tsar Alexander I in 1825, and there was a succession crisis. And to cut a long story short, Nicholas I comes to the throne. He's renowned for his reactionary attitudes, and the progressive section of the officer class launched a revolution in December 1825, and I'm sure you probably know it's called the Decembrist Revolt. And this rebellion was brutally put down. If you want to read about the Decembrist Revolt, probably the best thing to read is, as a prelude to it, is War and Peace by Tolstoy. If we fast forward to the 1840s, we find Nicholas is still on the throne, and many of the intelligentsia are heavily influenced by all sorts of Western liberal capitalist utopian socialist ideas. And this is where we find Dostoevsky, as I've already mentioned, hanging around with Belinsky, attending meetings of the Pretyshevsky Circle until his arrest and death sentence. He was sentenced to death, and this is what happened. He was all set up, ready to be shot, and then by pre-arrangement, the Tsar's aide-de-camp rides out and says, "You're not going to be shot. You're going to be go to jail instead." And Adam said to me at the beginning of the meeting, "Oh, isn't Dostoevsky the great philosopher of suicide?" This moment was pivotal. When he knew he had his life back, he wrote letters to his brother and to anyone else who would listen, saying, "Life, everything's about life. It doesn't matter what life brings. Life, if I had to stand on a ledge for 1,000 years and I couldn't move from the ledge, that would be better than dying." So I think that answers your point, Adam. No, I certainly wasn't a philosopher of suicide. When he's in jail, he comes face to face with criminal peasants. And first of all, he's repulsed by them. He can't understand them. They don't like him. They hate gentlemen prisoners. But eventually, he comes to understand there's a purity in their souls. And although they act in a certain way which he can't relate to and doesn't like, he thinks it's quite repulsive, he ends up thinking these are pure people who, in different circumstances, would be angels. And this is the raw material by which Russia can actually act as a beacon to the world through the peasantry. The intelligentsia of all stripes all fetishise the peasantry. I mean, don't forget, the peasantry was the biggest section of Russian society, biggest class. So virtually anybody who had anything interesting to say would always have to address the question of the peasants at some stage. Now, this example of his prison experiences are actually summed up, not summed up, but fictionalised, in a novel called House of the Dead, which is on the list, 1862, where he explains these ideas. And there's been a much copy done on how he changed or why he changed or what was going through his brain at the time. But changed he did. So bye-bye utopian socialism, back to Christianity, back to the Eastern Orthodox Russian Church, and the native soil conservative position. So now we're going to talk about the native soil conservative position. And I was a bit like, I missed out actually, because when I was printing off my thing this morning, I lost a page, and I think I was just going about to say what I was going to actually talk about. I'm going to talk about Dostoevsky's native soil conservatism and some of the themes that come from that. And then we're going to look at one of his novels in a little, not massive detail, because I haven't got all day, Crime and Punishment, and I hope you'll see the connection between the artistic form of his philosophy after I've explained some of the political philosophy that underpins it. And that's when we get to see the video. 5-minute video, so nothing to be scared of, just a little 5-minute clip. There he is, still there, Dostoevsky. Don't worry, David, I want it at the moment, but here he is, looking lovely as usual. I think this picture was drawn in 1872, so he was probably in his 40s at the time, do you think? Yeah, so, okay, Dostoevsky, I call this Dostoevsky's third position. I think I made that phrase up, I don't know if anyone else has used it. You've got the Slavophiles on the one hand, the right-wing Slavophiles, and you've got the radicals, socialists, utopian socialists, liberals on the other. In the middle, from the 1850s onwards, you had another tendency, which was called the native soil. And they're kind of inspired by Slavophilism, but they were a bit more nuanced. And this is where Dostoevsky comes in. So by the middle of the 19th century, there had arisen a prominent intelligentsia, which had been building up since the time of Peter the Great. Broadly speaking, it was divided into two groups, Westerners and Conservatives. Whilst the Westerners sought to continue the train set in motion by Peter, the Conservatives looked inwards and believed Russia's future would best be served by drawing on Russia's so-called unique heritage. That's the key philosophical distinction of Slavophilism. Russia is unique. Something that Dostoevsky died thinking, that Russia was unique. I mean, you might think it's a crazy view. It probably is. But geniuses do tend to have crazy views. It's almost what marks them out. This was also the so-called emancipation period, which culminated with the abolition of serfdom in 1861. This significant event came on the back of the death of Tsar Nicholas I and the Russian defeat in Crimea. Getting their own back now. The peasant question, the political elephant in the room, was finally dealt with, but the terms of the emancipation merely set up another set of problems. Russia was indeed in a state of flux, and the development of commercial and urban life added to the cauldron affecting the intelligentsia as well as the peasantry. Indeed, it is commonly argued that the intelligentsia was a socially estranged, alienated social milieu. It did not really sit well with Peter's table of ranks. Peter the Great set up a table of like a stratification system. Everyone knew where they were in society. The intelligentsia kind of didn't really fit in that very easily. Their membership came from a various strata, including the gentry, elements of which were becoming impoverished. And of course, anyone who's familiar with Russian literature at all in the 19th century will know that a lot of the work is about the decline of the gentry and how impoverished they're becoming and how indebted they're becoming and how they can't pay their mortgages. And they've mortgaged everything up. And even if you watch Chekhov plays, you can see it in Chekhov, you can see it, the novel Oblomov, written by Goncharov, great novel. It's about this idea of the indebted or the declining gentry. So this is where a lot of the intelligentsia are coming from. Also, they came from the bureaucratic nobility, the lesser bureaucracy, merchant families, and the like. The one thing they all shared was their education, but in many respects, this put them at odds with many of their fellow Russians. They really couldn't have conversations with people. You guys probably have the same experience when you're talking about socialism. I know I do. Even to people at work, it can feel that you're talking a different language. And imagine what it must have been like for these people. I believe that this alienation to be of deep significance, and I will demonstrate what it may have felt like when we look at Crime and Punishment later. However, these different tendencies shared much in common. That's the Slavophiles, Conservatives and the Radicals, which I believe is important when looking at Dostoevsky from a modern socialist standpoint. As Professor Wayne Dowler argued in his excellent book on Dostoevsky and the Native Soil Movement, I've got it in my bag, it's a really good book. Wayne Dowler, very, very good Canadian academic, who wrote his PhD thesis on this very issue. He wrote this: both radicals and conservatives amongst the intelligentsia feared the growth of capitalism. Conservatives too feared the growth of capitalism in Russia and adopted remarkably similar positions towards industrialization and the introduction of liberal constitutionalism. Both camps, until the advent of Marxism in the 1880s, envisaged a predominantly agrarian communal society in which industry, though not unimportant within the economy, remained on a small scale under community direction. Both preferred a self-governing federation of communes in which the powers of the central were drastically few. Both distrusted positive or formal law, seeing the key to social regulation instead in the moral convictions of the individuals and in a sense of common social purpose. Securing the freedom of the personality and the moral salvation of the individual was likewise a primary concern for both parties. So straight away, you've got conservatives who are adopting positions that most people in this room could at least nominally identify with. From this anti-capitalism, or as Dowler puts it, an abhorrence of Western bourgeois and capitalist, socialist and economic organisation, there was a touching faith in the peasant commune as something quintessentially Russian. In fact, the fetishisation of all things peasant was a common theme, as I've already mentioned, during the emancipation period. And this would become a key aspect of Dostoevsky's conversion experience. Now, Wayne Dowler, Professor Dowler, also points out that the intelligentsia also shared another common characteristic, the utopian spirit of the Romantic period, incorporating utopian socialism and the longing for the imagined social harmony, simplicity, and the spiritual unity of pre-industrial society. Here we see utopian socialism characterised as part of a fundamentally conservative longing. So what Dowler's arguing, and he's not probably the first person to say this, is the utopian socialists themselves, the people were influenced by Saint-Simon and Fourier, were actually quite conservative. And this is before the rise of Marxism in Russia. To underpin this point, Belinsky, who we've already met before, the critic who discovered Dostoevsky, the leading Russian critic of the day, he was a source of influence to both the left and the right. So you can see, once again, the connections. So what we see here are common ideas, threads and social backgrounds which span the range from the traditional conservative Slavophiles on the one hand, with their utopian conservative ideas of Russian history, to the radical westernizers and to Dostoevsky's tendency, the Native Soil Movement. Commented on Dowler's work, the great biographer of Dostoevsky, Joseph Frank, pointed out how little the political slogans of right and left meant in Russia and how close the two were in basic attitudes when looked at from a European point of view. So again, just reinforcing the point, the left and right in Russia, amongst the intelligentsia of the 1840s up to the 1870s, well, 1860s probably, were quite close. Whilst the Westerners based their ideas on borrowed Western ideas, Fourier, materialism, positivism, atheism, and Benthamite utilitarianism, the conservatives were philosophical idealists that were highly sceptical of abstract reason, preferring an organic analysis with a transcendental sensibility. Whilst this organic criticism was common to all conservative Slavophile thinking, this term was most commonly associated with a chap called Apollon Grigorev, Dostoevsky's main Native Soil influence. So his political mentor is this chap called Grigorev. In fact, it's probably fair to say that Dostoevsky didn't add anything original to political theory. He was taking his ideas from this current, and Grigorev was the main guy at the time. And these ideas of Grigorev, with of course obviously a few inflections by Dostoevsky himself, find their way into the post-Siberian novels. Arguably the main difference between the traditional conservatives and the Native Soil was Peter the Great's reforms. Whilst the traditionalists saw them as an alien imposition into Russian history and culture, so you've got the extreme right wing are arguing that the Tsar was out-radicalising or too radical for Russian society himself, Grigoriev and the Native Soil incorporated Peter's reforms into their analysis, into their organic analysis of Russian developments. They saw the Western deviation, as it were, of Russia under Peter as an organic part of Russian development. They didn't say, this is nothing to do with Russia, this is alien, totally and utterly disconnected to anything we live and breathe. They embraced it. These reforms were not a mistake or a wrong turn, but an integral part of Russian society. However, as is the case with all theories of nationalism, the main crux is social reconciliation as opposed to class struggle. And according to Professor Dowler, although ideas of reconciliation was a common trait amongst the intelligentsia, reconciliation attained its fullest expression with the native soil. Indeed, the critique of borrowed Western rationalism, or what Dostoevsky scholar Maria Banerjee calls the scandal of reason, is fundamental to understanding Dostoevsky's thought and that of the native soul. When his return to the Russian Orthodox Church, assuming he ever left, Dostoevsky became increasingly critical of attempts to restrict human freedom with abstract ideas that led straight to a form of determinism, or what he referred to as the socialist or even capitalist anthill. He had this phrase that abstract ideas, and it's the sort of stuff that Hayek talks about, actually, and people like that. You have abstract ideas and they lead to a kind of regulated society where the freedom of the individual is a compromise. So you end up with an anthill. And of course, he's juxtaposing that to his own version of an organic society. Indeed, this was the basis of his novelistic and journalistic attacks on the leading radicals of his day, including Chernyshevsky and Pizarev. Now, Chernyshevsky, he is the guy who wrote What Is to Be Done, which became a famous title used by Lenin. Lenin stole it from him. And he was the leading Marxist, he wasn't really a Marxist, but radical socialist in the 1850s, 1860s, that Dostoevsky fenced with. Lenin was very impressed by this guy. Given that the native soil were philosophical idealists, it should become as no surprise to learn that art was of fundamental importance to them. In fact, according to Dowler, it is impossible to fully appreciate the native soil without understanding the aesthetic theory from which it sprang. And by this, he's referring to the organic criticism elaborated by Grigoriev in the 1850s. In their polemics against the materialists, they argued that art was a superior form of knowledge to science because, and this is Dowler speaking, art was a spontaneous product of life. Science was the product of abstract reasoning from the categories of the mind. So you have it in that quote there, the difference. Dowler does point out that Dostoevsky was much more pragmatic than Grigoriev on this question. For Grigoriev, thought entered conscious life only through art, whereas for Dostoevsky, art was one of several agencies of human consciousness, along with science. However, along with the Slavophiles, both held the superiority of intuitive knowledge over conventional logical thought. So they're attacking logic, they're attacking rationalism, and juxtaposing it with a form of intuition. The native soil aesthetic theory was typically third positionist, between a utilitarian approach to art on the one hand and an art for art's sake approach on the other. I hinted earlier that the Socialist Party effectively defended, in my opinion, a de facto utilitarian approach to art and literature to propaganda. The idea of the propaganda model for socialism. You write something to explain the case for socialism in a rational way. So you read something and the idea is to convince the reader to become a socialist. Nothing inherently wrong with that, but there might be a few limitations. These were the kind of arguments that were going on in Russia at the time amongst the intelligentsia. The native soil people had a more pragmatic approach to the question of literature and art, and the materialists on the left were more utilitarian. I think we've continued that tradition. Putting the party case forward. Now, of course, the Socialist Party has been doing this for a long, long time, and we could discuss how successful it's actually been. And I don't say that in a scurrilous way. As I said at the beginning, I'm not joking. I have nothing but respect for the SPGB. I've been out of it for 12 years, and I probably feel closer to it now than I have done in the entire time I've been on the outside of it. So this is all done in a comradely fashion. But how effective is this model for making socialists? By its very nature, if you look at what the native soil people are doing or their approach to art, they have more of a sort of a fluid concept. So they don't sort of, they see art as not being, or literature, doesn't have a utility. It doesn't have a specific job to do in convincing someone of something. So, for example, it's quite possible you could become turned onto socialism by reading Dostoevsky that as much as you could do if you read Robert Tressel. It's possible. So all of mine, just put it out there. I mean, I think it's possible. Because sometimes some things come in through the back door, not always through the front door. So, yeah. And this idea of artistic flow. If things are always flowing, if things are always in a state of flux, they have a dynamism which dies the minute you put them in a box. And again, we're back to the critique of rational thinking. I think that within this aesthetic theory, one can feel the freedom for artistic expression, which lends itself to flow, flux, and vibrancy. Perhaps we can discuss how, if at all, this could be used for socialism. However, the problem is that if one has a static conception of what socialism is, a static aesthetic is what you'll get. Squaring this particular circle will not be easy. I know that the party has hitherto been proud of its precision when defining what socialism, or what even what capitalism is or is not. And there's little doubt that a useful, dare I say, utilitarian function has been achieved by such clarity. But if the revolutionary road to socialism is messy, irrational, with real flesh and blood elements making up the real movement, such an approach could be reactionary and dangerous, potentially, because it's based upon a category error, uncritical rationalism. Something to think about. It was partly for this reason that I decided not to take the utilitarian option and concentrate on the possessed. Steve's arm's probably a bit tired now, if I'm putting it up. I now offer a case study, or a little partial case study, of Crime and Punishment. If we could get the main character up, please, Dave. And hopefully we'll see a distillation of some of the things I've just been talking about. And we'll see some of the themes, some of these themes run through all of Dostoevsky's mature works. And I believe there are common elements with which socialists can identify with. So before you play the video, Steve, Dave, sorry, could we have the picture of Raskolnikov up, first of all? Oh, here we are. Meet Rodion Romanovich Raskolnikov, the hero, anti-hero of Crime and Punishment. Okay. A summary of this magnificent novel may go something like this. A poor former student kills a pawnbroker and her sister, ostensibly to rob her, with an axe. That's him. He's been thinking about this for a while, and when he has finally strengthened his resolve to actually do it, he falls apart both emotionally and morally in the wake of his action. The local police chief suspects it is him and ensnares him with devilish psychology, whilst a local prostitute offers redemption. Here is the crime, followed immediately by the self-inflicted punishment that eventually leads him to his formal punishment. It's a why done it rather than who done it. We know who did it at the beginning, so it's kind of like a detective novel on one hand, but the real issue is, why did he do it? And it's not even clear, I've read it five times now, why he did it. And there's lots of debates about what made this guy take an axe to a pawnbroker's head. So the main protagonist is Rodion Romanovich Raskolnikov. There he is, a 23-year-old former law student at the local university in St. Petersburg. He's recently been forced to leave university because of a lack of funds. He lives in a very cramped, low-ceiling room in the slum area of Petersburg, the Haymarket area. It's a stifling hot July, and he's cut himself off from everyone. He lays on his bed, thinking, gets up, walks around aimlessly, around the dirty streets, full of drinking dens, prostitutes, the sheer squalor of it all, talking to himself. You can almost taste the mortar in the air as you read. All this on an empty stomach. How did he end up like this? He feels above it all. He's feeling confined. He feels superior. Most of all, he needs air. Air, that comes from the novel. He's slipping into some kind of mental agitation, a psychosis or a monomania. He is haughty and proud and obviously thinks of himself as a superior intellectual. It is worth pointing out that these are largely inferences made by the reader, because Dostoevsky's style of writing was known as a polyphonic style, which is a phrase, I believe, invented by Mikhail Bakhtin. And what it is the characters kind of live and breathe by themselves. You can't really hear the author's voice. The characters speak for themselves. And this creates a certain atmosphere. When we first meet Rodion, there he is, he's trying to avoid his landlady amidst fantasizing about the crime he's going to commit. He draws the obvious conclusion as he repulses himself with his grotesque fantasy. How can I even consider doing that? That's taking the axe to the woman's head, which he's fantasizing about because he's planning it. How can I consider doing that when I'm scared of my landlady? Does that sound familiar to anybody? Exactly, yeah. This is the depths that Dostoevsky gets to. Those little thoughts you've ever had in your head and you think no one else has had is in the book. So this is guy, he's a superior radical intellectual. He's thinking, oh, I'm going to strike a blow. I'm going to take out a pawnbroker. I better avoid the landlady. Well, anything but see the landlady. I believe this is a key point. How many revolutionaries are actually scared of their own shadow and compensate by doing or thinking something outlandish, such as revolution? Dostoevsky's works in the space between our so-called rational judgment and our true selves, the meta-rational. Does it even make sense to ask the question, who are we really? This is the question. When you read Dostoevsky, the question comes up, what does it mean to be a human being? Who are we? Are we just a collection of contradictions bubbling away? And we come to an agreement about, this is the face I'm going to put out to these people, this is the face I'm going to put out to these people. And when we act on the world, we act within that context. Now, Rodion is in poverty, which means he's been frequenting an old pawnbroker. She's charmless and drives a hard bargain. How can he be on an inferior footing to her? She's a social parasite, and he has to kowtow to her, this louse. She's not even a human being, she's a louse. And the question he's forced to ask of himself is, am I also just a louse or am I a man? His notional plan is to kill and rob her, thus enabling him to fund his project for humanity. Now, this project for humanity, again, if you read other novelists, things are always stretched out and explained and you know where everything is. But Dostoevsky, you read it and you're thinking, what's this project? He doesn't really mention it. Sort of, the guy's talking to himself. He mentions the word project. That's all you get. So he's got this kind of project. He wants to do good things to humanity. But all you've got is this psycho walking around threatening to kill someone. During his days of inactivity and self-induced delirium, he's been working on a theory. Society moves forward by the actions of great men who have the right, or indeed take the right, to smash up existing ways of doing things in order to create new ones. The popular example that he always uses is Napoleon. Such people seem to intuitively know that they have that special right to transgress moral law, to step over. That's what the word crime means in Russian, to step over. They know that the resulting benefits to humanity will be worth the bloodshed in getting the new law through. You could even say Tony Blair with the war in Iraq. I mean, if he sleeps at night, then maybe he's a Napoleon. He had the right to do it, according to this theory, because he could do it and he could stay sane. Or maybe he's a psycho. That's the question. The truly great will not lose sleep because they know they have the sacred right. Pretenders, on the other hand, will not be able to sleep because their consciousness will not allow them. This, then, is the difference between great men and criminals. So a great man breaks the law, smashes up an old way with a new law, and if somebody stands in his way, he knows he's got the right to take them out, he or she. He takes them out, blood spills. It's okay because humanity is going to benefit as a result of this action. So it's obviously connected to the revolutionary project. How many people get injured in revolutionary road to communism? And who's going to do it? And is it worth it? And who has the right? By the 1860s, Russian radicalism had moved on from the propagandistic utopian socialism of the 1840s to a nihilism largely informed by, ironically, English utilitarianism. As Joseph Frank puts it, All the radical intelligentsia were convinced that the theories of English utilitarianism solved all the problems of ethics and personal conduct. In other words, might makes right, kill one person to benefit ten, that kind of thing. This has caused a great deal of confusion, because only in Russia do we find this peculiar blend of French utopian socialism with its belief in the possibility of a future world of love and moral perfection, held conjointly with a view of human nature stemming from the egotistical individualism of Bentham and Mill. Now, my favourite scene in the novel, which we're going to see in a minute, is the first battle between Profury, that's the police investigator, and Raskolnikov. They meet in a social situation, but Profury has already got Raskolnikov marked as a suspect. During these intense psychological games, of which Profury is definitely the master, even though he's not supposed to be, he produces an article written by Raskolnikov in a radical journal, which Raskolnikov has forgotten he's even written. It's almost like you've submitted something to the Socialist Standard, gone crazy, you've written an article saying, blow up the Houses of Commons or something. It gets published by Adam. You go slightly crazy in the meantime. Then you come to your senses and the police say, oh, I noticed you wrote an article in the Social Standard and there's this crime's happened. I wonder if it could be you. But in this scene we're going to see, it doesn't go like that. It's very, very subtle. He induces Raskolnikov to discuss the article and read from it. And Raskolnikov walks into every trap that he's set. Rodion, Raskolnikov, cannot believe he's been bested by his supposedly intellectual inferior. This is it. You've got the duffy old police chief who's a clever old boy, but he's not an intellectual. And Raskolnikov, 23 years old, thinks he knows everything, can't lay a glove on him. In every scene, the policeman plays Rodion like a fiddle, so adding to his psychosis. Cue film, please. So this is Dostoevsky's target, an amoral, utilitarian calculus embodied in the form of Raskolnikov. After meticulous planning, Rodion battles with himself, equivocates up to and during his act, and unforeseen circumstances, both internal and external, including the slaying of the poor broker's sister, who inadvertently turns up at the wrong time, screw up his calculus so much so that he's unable to carry out the action effectively. He does not even use the stolen money that he actually takes. It all falls apart straight away, demonstrating the inherent limitations of rational planning. I put that in quotes. And the validity of conscience, the meta-rational. Raskolnikov finds out the hard way that he's not a Napoleon after all. He's not a great man. Because Napoleon would have no problem stepping over the corpse of a socially useless moneylender. No, it turns out he did not have the right, thus making him a criminal of the ordinary kind that transgress whilst inwardly accepting the justice and validity of the law they are breaking. His only way out is to accept suffering and redemption through the Christian prostitute Sonia, who urges him to confess so that God can give him new life. However, I have my criticisms of the view that the utilitarian calculus was the prime mover in Raskolnikov's crime, or if you want to call it a crime. Yes, he was influenced by ideas in the air, that's a phrase from the novel, but he'd long since given up social life. Indeed, his only friend, Razumikin, was possibly a native soul-inspired person. Yes, his only friend. So his only friend, the only form of contact he has is with a guy who's probably a native soily type. It doesn't actually say that, but you can draw inferences. So I believe his alienation and estrangement from both a personal and social point of view is the best place to start. We already know that the basic sociological position of the intelligentsia was one of alienation, and there were certain personal psychological circumstances at play that show Raskolnikov reacting differently to poverty than, for example, Razumikin, who works. He even offers Raskolnikov work, translation work, but Raskolnikov doesn't want to do it. Either he's lazy or he thinks it's beneath him. Anyone had that feeling before? For a future project, I would like to use Marx's theory of alienation as a means for analysing the central characters in Crime and Punishment, because despite its reputation as a psychological novel, I think that Dostoevsky's writings remain essentially social, or even social-psychological, thus collapsing the artificial divide between the young pre-Siberian writer and his mature post-prison phase, and by extension, the left and the right phase. It is true that Raskolnikov accepted defeat, but it's not clear whether the theory failed or he failed the theory. Ultimately, he dared to see if he was one of the elect and found he wasn't. He failed his own test because his humanity got in the way. It's worth pointing out that we find out retrospectively that Raskolnikov's quite a nice guy, actually, before he had his mental illness. He regularly helped poorer people out. He's pulled a couple of kids out of a burning fire before the novel starts. We find this out in the epilogue. So when we meet him, we meet a different side to him completely. And this is Dostoevsky's central point. There are certain intuitions that tie us together and cannot be undone by abstract reason. We may not be able to quantify, prove it, or plot it on a graph, but we know that it's there, and this unknown quality is what Dostoevsky, I think, calls God and the example of Jesus Christ. However, there would be no point in trying to disprove the existence of God, Dawkins style, or rationally, Dostoevsky, because it's probably the case that Dostoevsky never really settled the question in his own mind. He once wrote that he was a child of doubt, and that, and this is an important thing to remember, if someone succeeded in proving to me that Christ was outside the truth, and if indeed the truth was outside Christ, I would sooner remain with Christ than with the truth. So the God delusion would be of no use here. Or the standard arguments people like ourselves use, you just bounce off, it's irrelevant. Dostoevsky would probably agree with you. But he's saying, you're missing something, guys. There's something, that funny feeling you get inside, you're not accounting for it because you can't say what it is, you can't put words to it. Therefore, you say it doesn't count. He's saying it does count. This was the basis of his own utopian vision that via Russian Orthodoxy and its unique example of self-sacrifice, Russia, rather than the West, would become the beacon for hope in the world. So one could apply Dostoevskian logic to this and draw the conclusion that any messianic vision on this scale could only lead to tears, no matter how organic the theory. So I'm kind of like paying Dosti back in his own coin now. Indeed, next to this, the SPGB looked very reasonable, whilst Dostoevsky suddenly looks dangerous. And I mean that in a good way. In addition, Marx took action against the nihilists in the First International by expelling Bakunin and his friends for the very reasons that Dostoevsky identified. A revolution by majority action and the legitimate capture of state power surely must act as a bulwark against the kind of things Dostoevsky was worried about. In fact, one of the reasons I joined the SPGB, because when was it, back in 1993, was because I wanted an organisation that wanted revolution but wasn't prepared to do it in such a way that it was going to be arrogant, I suppose. You know, it had to be legitimate. And if this is Dostoevsky's point, then I think it's well made. I'm not saying necessarily the SPGB's theory of revolution is correct. I'm merely making out that on this level, you and Dostoevsky could have a thing in common here, despite the fact that he is a native soil conservative. What this all shows is that we should always proceed with caution, whatever our utopian projects. Dostoevsky may well make uncomfortable reading for socialists, but we should thank him for that. His work and political ideas retain a flow, particularly reflected in his theory of art, and I do believe socialists can learn from this. The anti-statism, the idea of the commune, albeit with a czar, show that Dostoevsky remained a kindred spirit and never doubted the sincerity of the radicals. He never did. He never, ever challenged the sincerity of the radicals. He was got quite... In the 1870s, there was almost a rapprochement between certain tendencies. He didn't hate them. He just thought they were misguided. And I think on a psychological level, that's quite important. He believed in a human brotherhood. And as I understand it, so do we. So we should not doubt his sincerity. And likewise, I expect him not to doubt ours. Thank you. Ah!